This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the financial crisis we've been living through these last few years, and with me to discuss this is one of the most perceptive scholars and activists on the subject, David McNally. David McNally is professor of political science at York University, and he's the author of several books, including Political Economy and the Rise of Capitalism, and Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism. He's got two new books that are just about ready to come out on the current crisis, Global Slump, The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance, and Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. He's also active, by the way, in a lot of great activism work. David McNally, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks very much, Matt. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I was researching your work in preparation for this interview, and I saw some great lectures you've been giving that were up on the internet. And you talk about this global crisis in a way that I really haven't heard many people talk about it. So why don't we just start at the beginning and answer this question: what caused the crisis? Why did this thing implode?
Right. Okay. Well, it is really the key question in a lot of ways. And I guess really at the heart of my argument is to suggest that in a really important sense, where big business is concerned, neoliberalism worked. And what I mean by that is there have been a lot of commentators on the left who have said since the early 1970s, capitalism has been in crisis. We're now into 30 or 40 years of a crisis. And I think that's really to miss the huge transformations that took place from the late 1970s, early 1980s onwards. It's not just that neoliberalism was nasty, which it was. It worked for big business, for capital. And what I mean by that is they got more out of workers for less. That means that workers became more productive and more profitable for capital. Workers' wages became relatively poorer, their conditions of work, their benefits, and so on. This meant that neoliberalism was making capitalism profitable again, and it was doing that both by squeezing the existing workforce and by geographically locating the development, particularly of new centers of growth like China. So my argument is that capitalism is a system in which growth produces crisis, not in which crisis goes on and on and on, decade after decade, generation after generation. And what we're witnessing now, I'm arguing, is the first worldwide systemic crisis of the neoliberal phase of capitalism. And as a result, it's something new. It's not same old, same old. We are living through what a couple of mainstream authors have called a transformative moment. And all of global economics and politics, I think, will be very, very different for the next decade or more.
What's new about it? Because, of course, capitalism has its crises, its booms, and its busts. So what is definitive about this one?
Well, what's new about it is that rather than just being what we might call a cyclical crisis, capitalism goes through its ups and its downs, and that's the way the mainstream still likes to present what happened since 2008. Rather than just a cyclical crisis, I'm suggesting that, as I say, it's a systemic crisis. And systemic crises, most recent historical examples are the Great Depression, or also the period between 1973 and 1982, when you just get recession upon recession upon recession, and capitalism can't create sustained growth. These are decade-long periods. That's why I use the word slump. It may be a series of recessions, but what's different about it is that capitalism cannot easily get back to growth. And this is because it's over-accumulated. That worldwide, too many factories, too many mines, too many mills, too many shopping malls, too many office towers, and so on, have been constructed than they can use profitably. And we are in one of those great crises of overcapacity, which takes capitalism a long time to get out of. And the way they do that is by inflicting enormous damage on the working class and the poor. And that's what I think we're in for now, the so-called decade of austerity that was being talked about in the mainstream press in recent months.
And we're seeing some of that assault. But before we get into what the nature of the assault is, I'm just wondering why this assault or why this offensive is rational for capital, because after all, it wants consumers to be able to buy products.
Yeah, and this is the crazy thing. It's both rational and irrational. And I do want to emphasize this about capitalism, that when it gets into these kinds of crises, what they have to do to get out actually makes the crisis worse for a period of time. Because, as you say, it seems nuts to argue that we're in the midst of a crisis, let's lay off more workers, let's cut their wages, let's cut social programs, because all of this drives consumer demand even lower. And so at that level, it's damaging the economy. The problem is that capitalists don't operate with the best interests of the economy at heart. The issue for them is how to return to profitability, how to get profits back to a normal level for them. And to do that, they've got to cut costs, even though it means damage to the economy as a whole for a period of time. And so what they're doing, which is rational for their interests, actually has these irrational impacts on the economy as a whole.
And so the way they're cutting costs is to inflict pain to drive wages down? Is that what they're doing?
Well, yeah, that's the first stage of it, and we really saw that. But then, of course, the second stage now, because they used the government sector to bail out the banking system, now having laid off millions of workers, having done their best to push down wages, to reduce benefits and so on, now they're moving to phase two of their attack on working people, which is the big attacks on government programs. This is coming under the name of deficit reduction, and they're now talking the term both, first it was decade of austerity that the International Monetary Fund and others started to talk about. Around the time of the G20 meetings in June, the phrase age of austerity started to come out. We're talking about a decade or more in which they're going to try to cut social programs as the second phase of trying to get costs under control.
I'm speaking with David McNally. He's professor of political science at York University, and he's got a couple books coming out on this crisis. A Global Slump is one of them, called The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. You were at the G20, I take it. What was that like?
I was. That was really interesting, shocking at times, frightening at times. Interesting because simply in terms of the theme that we're talking about now, it was the clearest collective statement by the leaders of the 20 largest economies in the world that the order of the day is deficit reduction. The order of the day is to cut government spending. This is what they feel must be the overall priority. They gave Japan a break on that, but everybody else publicly committed to it. But the other side of it, of course, is when you're talking about a decade of austerity, you're also talking about a lot of social protest and resistance. Greece has been the most obvious example in recent months. And I believe that one of the things they were doing was deliberately holding this G20 in a major urban center. Recently, they have tried to move these meetings into much smaller locales. They came back into a major urban center, the largest city in Canada, Toronto. And I think they did that because they wanted to test out their capacity to police social protest. They spent $1.1 billion on security for this four-day event. They brought 20,000 police into the city of Toronto. They walled off the whole area where the conference would be happening. They passed special laws so they could arrest anybody who came near these walls. And over the course of the event, they arrested more than 1,100 protesters, and not just protesters, bystanders, tourists, anybody who got in the way. They beat them up. They used special detention centers. It was the largest mass violation of civil liberties in Canadian history. And we've got a number of legal suits now against police forces on this. So I think the other side of it was, in addition to committing themselves to austerity, they were testing out their capacity to control social protests, because I think they see a lot of it coming over the next decade.
So in a way, David McNally was a dress rehearsal.
It was a dress rehearsal. Yeah, I think that's right. They're watching what they've been doing in Greece, and they're thinking, we've got more of these general strikes coming in different parts of the world. We've got more mass protests in the streets as we savage education and healthcare and so on. We better learn to deal with it now. So let's do a dress rehearsal. Let's do a test case.
You mentioned that deficit reduction is the order of the day from those who are in charge of the economy, and also seemingly the corporate mainstream intellectual class talks about it too. With the exception of Paul Krugman in the New York Times, everyone mm-hmm. else is singing from the same book. Even the Obama administration talks about deficit reduction. Yet it's a joke. I mean, after all the money that has been squandered on these wars and on the bank bailout, talk about the dimensions of that and why there always seems to be money for wars and corporate welfare, but not money for the social needs of the populace.
Yeah, it's a really important point, Matt, because we need to keep reminding people that in order to preserve global capitalism and the world's banking system, governments around the world invested and then spent by way of stimulus programs to get the economy going again, $20 trillion at least. My guess is it's around $21 trillion at this point. Now, to give listeners a sense of that, that's 1.5 times the annual gross domestic product of the U.S. spent to bail out the banking system and prevent the whole market economy from collapsing. This is from the same people who tell us they can't fund social welfare, they can't expand education and healthcare, and so on. So what it tells us very clearly is that those who run the system have their priorities. And when it's the world's banks that are at issue, they can come up with it. But now they're saying to themselves, we've overspent. We don't think financial markets like deficits of this size. How are we going to pay back? And the answer is, we're basically going to take it out of the hides of poor and working class people by way of reducing social programs for the next decade. Really interesting study out of Britain recently, a very mainstream financial think tank that says by 2018, the average working class family in Britain will be $4,500 poorer as a result of cuts to programs for things they're now going to have to pay for, they used to be able to get as social entitlements, and as a result of higher taxes. That's a huge assault that's coming.
Mm. But how do they get away with it? These people who make policy, who they say one day we can spend $20 trillion, and the next, well, of course, they don't say that out loud, but if you do the math as you mm-hmm. do, it amounts to $20 trillion, and the next day say, cupboard's bare, we can't spend anything.
Yeah. I think what they're relying on is the damage that has been done to social movements, trade unions, and the left during the neoliberal period. They're counting on, in that sense, our incapacity to sufficiently mobilize people, to do the popular education necessary, to really pose alternatives, to get across an analysis and ways of organizing and resisting in which we would begin to define a different agenda. And so long as they control the whole ideological political agenda, they think they can essentially say to people, this is what we need to do to keep the economy alive. And if we don't do this, our system is sunk. And until there are really clear social alternatives that are resonating with large numbers of people, they think they can more or less get away with it. And in a certain sense, they're right, although I think they also know that there is resistance coming.
Right. But it's extortion and blackmail, and it's to select only one option out of a range of options to say, if we don't do this, if we don't spend $700 billion to bail out Wall Street with no conditions whatsoever, exactly, the whole economy is going to fall apart and we'll be in martial law.
Yeah.
That's basically what they said to the members of the House of Representatives and to the senators.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So they're saying it again.
They are saying it again.
And you write about our incapacity that so far the response from the left, from progressive intellectuals, has been unimaginative and routine.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I mean a couple of things. One is I'm really worried, going back to our starting point of the discussion, that too many people see this as same old, and don't realize just what a transformative moment it is that we're living through. And as a result, I think a lot of people on the left have stayed with the kind of typical practices. I believe new constituencies for the left are being created right now, and that part of our task is to think really creatively and imaginatively about new ways of bringing together non-sectarian forces that really want to unite both in action, in education, in mobilization. Very small example, we've brought a couple of hundred plus activists together in Toronto to create something called the Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly. It's a small beginning, but it's got about five social movements and left groups who have said, let's start a real process of a meaningful coalition to create new frameworks for the left in this city. Otherwise, we're gone. We have no relevance. And I think starting to think in new terms about what this next decade requires, which is really important if we're going to imaginatively respond.
Have you been surprised by the rise of the grassroots right wing in the United States, the so-called Tea Party movement, and do you think there's a risk of fascism?
I suppose it's at one level I was surprised only because the first wave of response to the crisis was one in which you could see the elements of, if I can put it in these terms, the next left. I'm thinking about things like the occupation of Republic windows and doors in Chicago, the factory occupations that we saw in Ontario, in Ireland, in Britain, the boss snappings in France, general strikes in Guadeloupe and Martinique. You saw this is wave of resistance. We're not going to pay. We're not going to let them take our jobs and so on. But that sputtered. And I think it sputtered for the reasons we were just talking about, the fragmentation and disarray of the left. And I think in the next moment when there was this pause in resistance, then the right tried to assert itself. And I suppose we should have seen that coming. At the same time, I'm reminded there was a really interesting commentary in one of the largest newspapers in Toronto, which said, you know something, if you compare the size of the pro-immigrant rights mobilizations around Arizona to the Tea Party events, it's the pro-immigrant rights mobilizations that are much, much larger in terms of the numbers of people on the ground. And so I think that's a strategic problem for the left. How do we recognize those constituencies and start to link them together in a new movement?
I'm speaking with David McNally. He's professor of political science at York University, and he's been writing about and talking about this global slump and how distinctive and new and alarming it is. He's got a couple books coming out on the subject. One's called Global Slump, and the other is Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. David McNally, one thing that I have heard you say in response to critics of neoliberalism, and one characteristic of neoliberalism is deregulation, and yet you posit that deregulation actually wasn't the cause of this crisis, whereas we've been hearing, and I've been saying too, that deregulation may have been a cause with the knocking down of Glass-Steagall and the loosening up on trading on all sorts of exotic credit default swaps and things we'd never even heard of 4 years ago. Why wasn't that a cause?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matt. And I think what I'm trying to say is the flaw in the argument that pins everything on deregulation is that it assumes some policymakers in Washington came under lobbying influence and decided to deregulate the banks, and that sent the financial system into a tailspin. I want to ask a larger question, which is where did deregulation come from? Why did they start doing this? And my argument is that it really has to do with a lot of the structural changes in the globalization period, in which the regulated model of banking that developed after the Second World War, really during the Great Depression, no longer fit the way capitalism was organizing itself. What worries me about the emphasis simply on deregulation is it implies, oh, let's re-regulate the banks and capitalism will be stable again. I think that horse has left the barn. I think that capitalism is now genuinely so globalized that it's not that deregulation created it. Deregulation was a response to this new structural organization of capitalism as a system. And that's what we've got to address, those underlying root causes, those systemic causes, and not just the policy changes.
So if re-regulation is not going to work, short of overthrowing capitalism, what's going to work?
Well, really, I think what we're talking about is the building of large-scale social movements that begin to shift the balance of social forces in society, that they actually win reforms by pressure from below that begin to change the very terrain on which we're operating. It's what some historians have often described as the New Deal from below. It wasn't all about the Roosevelt administration. You had these insurgent new unions, unemployed workers' movements, cultural organizations, and so on, which started to shift the very balance of power in society. I used an example in a talk yesterday that banks in the U.S. are sitting on $1.3 trillion of capital that they're not using because businesses aren't investing. Well, what if you began to actually demand the recirculation of that wealth from the banks for green economy investments that would be both job-creating and environmentally sustainable? That's going to involve social movements that can say the wealth of society ought to be invested for social and public purposes, not just in terms of what's profitable. So I think short of the complete overthrow of capitalism, there are the kinds of reforms that can be won by grassroots social mobilization. But short of that movement building work, I don't think we're going to get very much at this point. And that's why I want the left to think not just in terms of the policy debates, but in terms of the question of how do we rebuild grassroots social movements, make working class left movements a reality again. And as I say, if it's a long-term crisis, then we need to be thinking of where do we want to be in 5 years and in 10 years rather than just next week's demonstration.
Well, and how do you draw those linkages then and try to rebuild the social movement from below? There has been some exciting work on immigrant rights in the United States and in Canada. The AFL-CIO, which used to be hidebound on the issue, now has a progressive position on the issue. So that's one area. What are some others?
I think part of it is this idea that I was speaking to earlier of starting to identify who's actually organizing on the ground and bringing those people into conversations about what kinds of wider coalitions, assemblies, and movements we can build. One of the first things we did early on in the crisis in Toronto was we created something called the Popular Education and Action Project. And we simply brought the best migrant justice movements, anti-poverty movements, the non-sectarian left groups, and others together and said, let's start to work together. We all realize we need to be able to make a more substantial response to this crisis. And I think we've got, most of the time, given where the left is today, we're going to begin locally. We're going to begin with who's actually doing the grassroots work. But I think a lot of people out there and some of the new constituencies you see get awakened around things like Arizona or the cuts to social programs in California can be brought into this process.
And one thing also is the foreclosure, anti-foreclosure movement. I mean, locally you can press your sheriffs and your city councils and your county councils to say we're not going to serve notices and kick people out of their homes. This happened in the 30s where not only cities but some states said they weren't going to do that, and that was in response to people going out and defending the homes.
Exactly.
And sometimes militantly defending the homes.
Right.
And that is the kind of thing we may need. You've said that you've seen the future and it's California. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. What I was trying to get across to people is if you look at the scale of the cuts that have been introduced in California and you look at how sweeping they are, everything from healthcare programs for hundreds of thousands of poor people, for rural migrant workers, the cuts to higher education and healthcare, the various attempts to cut workers' wages either by mandatory days off and so on. I think that is what we're looking at for a decade or more. And I think we need to understand that when they come for phase one of the cuts, it's not over. Often they try to create the mentality, oh, let's just ride this out and then we'll be back to the good old days, which weren't, of course, so good. But in fact, there's phase two and there's phase three and there's phase four, because we're talking about poor and working class people paying for a $20 trillion bailout. And I think as a result, when I say the future is California, I'm really saying that massive draconian wave of cuts that Schwarzenegger brought in, that's just the beginning. And one constituency after another, that's what we're going to see for years to come. And we better understand that to figure out how to resist it.
In one way, it's playing out with an intellectual assault from the mainstream corporate media and leaders on the right is to pit public sector workers against private sector workers. Oh, you've got it so good in the public sector. You know, why should you get these benefits? Why should you get these higher wages when, you know, people in comparable jobs in the private sector are getting peanuts? You should get peanuts too. That seems to be the slogan. And what's the best counter to that?
Well, you're right. The old divide and rule is, I think, the classic tactic in these circumstances. If your situation is precarious, point to someone's whose is less so, and then say, see, it's that person that's the issue. In this case, as you say, the nurse, the teacher, the social worker, and so on. And we can only really counter that, I believe, when we start bringing constituencies together and saying, we cannot afford to blame one another. We are saying, raise everybody's job security to the level of the best. Improve everybody's benefits to the level of the best. You say the money's not there. You say this will bankrupt society. Let's look at the bank bailout again. Let's look at the $1.3 trillion that the banks are sitting on, and so on. In other words, really giving people a concrete sense that the social wealth is there, that that's not the issue. The question is the political capacities to demand social control over that wealth. That is to say, that public priorities will dictate the use of the wealth which is there. Otherwise, the divide and rule tactic will work unless, as a left, we produce concrete, meaningful responses that are tangible to people, that aren't just an abstraction like, you know, make the rich pay or something. I mean, that's great.
So by tangible, you know, increase living wages, paid sick leave, paid maternity leave, things like that.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And when they say we can't afford it, pointing to the very real mechanisms by way of corporate taxes, the so-called Tobin taxes, the kinds of reforms that could actually begin some process of redistributing wealth. And it's not that I think this will make capitalism a perfect system. It's that the process of organizing to demand more, if you win, people's horizons start to expand. Their sense of what's possible grows. And so this is why I'm talking about the kind of reforms from below that are won by social movements that are pressing a new agenda.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I was wondering if you had an assessment on Barack Obama's economic policy and what's driving that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this is the really classic conundrum, and I think we're going to see governments around the world vacillate, just like the Obama administration is. On the one hand, talking austerity, then looking at the unemployment numbers, which are not budging, as you know, and going, oh, we need a little stimulus. But the reality is that the policy is predominantly now driven by the austerity agenda. And so in some cases, it's literally just raiding one program, food stamps, let's say, to pay for another. That's what they committed themselves at the G20, to austerity, to deficit reduction, to cutting social programs. But these governments need to get reelected. They will make tactical shifts and turns to look like they're going back to stimulus and so on. But the reality is that the overall trajectory of the Obama administration is an austerity one, but it's a zigzagging austerity one. And that's why people have to be clear that its policies are part of the problem. And there will not be a solution coming from government quarters without the movements that push for it.
Hmm. I think that's a crucial note to end on. David McNally, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine.
Thanks, Matt. I've really enjoyed it.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.